Today is March 14th. And the secretary will take the role of the task force members present. It's good to have you back with us. Familiar faces and some new faces. There's nothing like final recommendations to focus attention and concern.
I remember.
So we welcome everyone to the table. I'd like to remind members as we get started that we are on teleconference today to Fairbanks, Homer, and Soldotna. We'd like to welcome those participants who are at those sites and remind committee members to please use your microphones conscientiously as we go through today's discussion. There's a great deal of interest across the state in the work that we're doing here, and we want to make sure that the public has full access to the information we're discussing. I'd also want to note as we start that we appreciate Larry Bartlett making time in his schedule to be back with the task force. He was there last time, as you know. He has made time in his schedule for us that was not originally contemplated in his contracts, and we appreciate his flexibility and his, as well as his expertise. Today's meeting, there has been discussion in the past whether this would be a work session. This was that was the original plan. I think our thoughts about this sort of evolved over time, and today's meeting was advertised in papers across the state as a task force meeting. I think our goal is to try and get as much done as we possibly can and reassess as we go throughout today's meeting how much time, if any, we will require tomorrow for the deliberations of the task force. So we'll take that as we go. I'd like to note that members received in their packets copies of the minutes from the draft minutes from the last task force meeting. Because those are the draft recommendations to adopt the minutes might be tantamount to adopting the recommendations without discussion this morning of the task force, I'm going to solicit a motion to approve the minutes and then hold that motion for later in the task force's meetings for final approval of the minutes. So the chair will solicit a motion at this time. The roll has been taken.
Mr. Chairman, what?
Senator.
Chairman, what are you doing here in this motion request? Does that leave it to the discretion of the chairman whether the motion then is approved or not? What is the motion?
No. Well, we need not even take a motion now. If you all will, so I don't want to complicate things. I was going to solicit a motion to approve the minutes and then to ask for unanimous consent for discussion of that motion later in today's meeting. People may not have had a chance to review their packets prior to this meeting, so why don't we just, I'll solicit a motion at a later time in the task force deliberations after you all have had a chance to see the amendments, or to see the minutes. The point was that the minutes are the draft recommendations from last time, so to approve them now would be to, anyway, I think you get the point. We'll just hold off on the minutes then until later. Senator Duncan, did you have any comments before we jump into the agenda? Okay. Is there any discussion before we do of the agenda for today's portion of the meeting? Pretty simple and pretty straightforward. Senator and then Sister Donna Taylor.
I just wanted to repeat one statement that you made, President Ellis, and see if there's any disagreement on the task force. President Ellis indicated we did advertise this as a formal meeting, and so I think the intention would be here as we progress through this process today that we may be taking formal action and final action so that we don't go through a work session today and then have to come back and repeat the entire process for formal action tomorrow. So we really will be operating the formal committee structure, and motions that are made and taken will be formal committee action unless there's disagreement from the task force members.
No, I just want to, right, I'm glad you clarified that. In the sense of the group seems to be, from eye contact that I'm making, to do it once, do it officially today to the extent that we get through the recommendations and proceed from there. Okay, so, Sister Donna, I'm sorry.
Yes, I'm wondering if we might discuss the issue of medical malpractice, formulate a recommendation for that before we go through the detail of this so that we'll be sure our recommendation is part of this proposal.
Okay, you're suggesting that we switch items 2 and number 1 on the agenda. We, I guess, would need to determine if the folks who were to make presentations this afternoon are all with us earlier in the day than the afternoon time slot we gave them on the agenda, and if they're prepared to make their presentations sooner rather than later. Senator Petula? And could I ask you to use your microphone, please?
Yes, I apologize. If, and it seems logical to me that you might go through this exercise first, and I don't intend to try to involve myself very much here, just catching up. But I've spoke to you briefly and Senator Duncan. If there's time, I'd like Dr. Weiss to be able to testify, perhaps right after this medical malpractice, because it ties in very distinctly to whatever time that you're going to be discussing that particular issue, whenever that comes up. He only needs 10 minutes or so. Thank you.
And Senator, this the agenda was prepared in writing before we had our discussion, and so that not appearing here is not meant to preclude that presentation. So we're, Senator Duncan and I are happy to make that opportunity available. Okay, any further discussion? I don't know, Sister Donna, are the representatives from the Health Access and Cost Containment Council here, or were you or Senator or Dr. Wilson going to make that presentation?
I'm going to do that.
Okay. And the Division of Insurance.
There's a memorandum, Mr. Chairman, that is at the back table that I think will respond to questions that we put to us.
Okay. And you're prepared to review that with us to get through those points? Okay. Well, I'm going to put you on the spot there. And the folks from the Alaska Trial attorneys, are you all ready to go then and comfortable with moving the presentation? Okay. We could invite you to join us at the table then. Good morning. If you could identify yourself for the record, please, and then go ahead with your prepared remarks.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dan Hensley. I'm a practicing lawyer in Anchorage, Alaska, and a member of the...
Okay. And Dan, could I ask you to use not just an amplification mic, but a teleconference mic as well?
Is that better? My name's Dan Hensley. I'm a practicing lawyer. We'll get going here. All right, we'll try again. Thank you for inviting me to participate and make a presentation. I practice law in Anchorage. I'm also a member of the Anchorage Trial Lawyers Association, which is a group of lawyers who represent injured plaintiffs. I think it might be useful for me to briefly review for some of the members of the task force the history of what is known as tort reform in the state of Alaska. And I'll try to be as brief as I can, although the history is relatively long. In 1967, this legislature passed its first laws dealing with medical malpractice litigation. Those laws were prompted by a Alaska Supreme Court decision, which, by my research, was the very first Alaska court decision holding a doctor liable for medical negligence. The next year, Speaker of the House, Tom Fink, told the members of the legislature that there was an unprecedented rise in medical malpractice insurance rates and the legislature needed to do something about it, and Alaska's first tort reform was passed. 10 years later, in 1976, we had another crisis, or that's what it was labeled. Governor Hammond appointed a task force, much like this one. Had legislators, citizens, representatives of the medical community, the insurance community. They worked for 6 months focusing on issues related to insurance rates, malpractice litigation, peer review, policing of bad medicine, a number of interrelated issues, and passed what the legislature at that time described as a comprehensive medical malpractice reform package. It included all of the demands that the medical community had at the time, which were thought to be a panacea, a cure-all for whatever the problem was, including medical screening panels, panels of physicians who reviewed every medical malpractice case that was filed and whose panel report could be used to throw out the plaintiff's case unless the plaintiff had an expert consultant who disagreed with that panel report. That 1976 law adopted probably the strictest collateral source rule that still exists in the country today, and it adopted a number of other planks in 76 as well. As a result of that task force, 10 years later in 1986, we did it all over again. This time the legislature adopted global tort law changes that applied not only to medical malpractice but to other personal injury litigation. But those global changes also applied to medical malpractice litigation. That process was the result of a fine-tuned compromise in which many interests were considered. The interests of injured victims were considered, the need or perceived need to lower liability insurance rates in all areas were considered, and after a considerable amount of debate and discussion, what many of us thought was a compromise was reached, and I know some of you legislators who are sitting here today were promised that that would be the end of it. 1987, 1988, 1989, 1990, and 1991, the same folks who promised that the 1986 compromise would be the end were back down here asking for more. One of the important points I left out, which I need to back up to, in 1976, the comprehensive medical malpractice package was part of a compromise as well. On the one hand, we adopted some fairly strict laws restricting how medical malpractice litigation can be conducted. On the other hand, and as a trade-off, physicians were required to be insured by the legislature. And MICA, an in-house nonprofit medical malpractice insurance corporation, was formed by the legislature to insure those physicians who could not obtain private insurance elsewhere. The trade-off, the compromise, was this. In exchange for hopefully reducing medical insurance rates through the relatively strict planks of the medical malpractice legislation was increased insurance for physicians and increased review and peer review and discipline of physicians through the mandatory insurance and the MICA corporation. The next year, the legislature repealed the compromise portion, the mandatory insurance portion, but the restrictions on liability insurance remained in place. That in sum, is the history of tort reform in the state, and it's also the history of compromise on tort reform in the state. Essentially, there's a history of various task force, various legislators, believing they have compromised the issues and balanced the interests of all persons involved by the legislation, only to be hit with a barrage year after year of additional necessary changes. What many of us think is really occurring by this history, if you look at it over the period of about 20 years, is that the medical community is seeking complete immunity from being involved in the tort system, and it's seeking to obtain it piece by piece by piece. If it can't be obtained in one legislative package, then year after year after year, a small piece will be obtained. And that appears to be the approach that has been taken. And I think that's important when you're considering the overall package that's been proposed and the suggestions for compromise, that I think it's important to consider the history that we have today. It seems as if you say something enough, even if it isn't true, people tend to start believing it. And I think that one of the issues we're here to talk about today illustrates that principle better than anything else. It has been said for 5 or 8 or 10 years that medical malpractice litigation is one of the major drivers of increased costs in medical care in our nation and in our state. It's said over and over again. It's said so much that folks tend to believe it. When I go into a meeting with folks who have not looked at the empirical data, who haven't done a lot of reading about the subject, the initial conversation always begins with that assumption, and I have to deal with that assumption. But what we found through the empirical data is that simply isn't true. I've provided some written materials to members of the task force based on American Medical Association, insurance data, and other similar data, data not prepared by lawyers, but prepared by statisticians, physicians, scientists, and such. The numbers are this. Of the perhaps $600 billion that the nation spends annually on health care, less than 1% of that, maybe closer to 0.8% of that, is spent on medical malpractice premiums. 0.8%. And out of that 0.8% of that total budget comes all of the medical malpractice litigation, comes compensation for victims, comes payment of the defense lawyers who defend physicians, comes payment of the plaintiff's lawyers who represent the victims, comes the profit of the insurance companies who receive the premiums. Out of that, less than 1%, all of those things occur. The entire legal, medical legal system, other than the court system, which is paid from another budget, is out of that less than 1%. I wish that I could say that this task force or the legislature or that I got to spend 99% of my time discussing the real issues which deal with the increased costs of health care and 1% of the time discussing medical malpractice, but I'm afraid that's not the case. Another truism, another issue that folks, if you say it long enough, folks tend to believe, is that defensive medicine is what's driving up the cost of health care. That is not clear at all. There are very few empirical studies dealing with defensive medicine. Defensive medicine is, as I understand, physicians ordering extra tests or doing extra procedures or taking extra steps that are not necessary for their patients' care merely to avoid being sued. The most recent study that I've seen, the Harvard study, that was a study done by Harvard University for the legislature of the state of New York, found that there was very little evidence of defensive medicine being practiced in that study. That same study found that only one out of every eight persons who receives negligent medical care ever files a lawsuit, and only half of those people, or one out of 16, is ever compensated by the system. But on the issue of defensive medicine, what the Harvard study says, I believe we have provided that to you folks in a previous package of information, but I can always provide more copies, is that when they did that study, what they did was they pulled 35,000 or 40,000 charts of people who had bad outcomes in New York hospitals, ranging from government hospitals to any inner city hospitals to wealthy private hospitals. And they did a retrospective analysis of whether the care provided in those bad outcomes was negligent. And what they found was that there was very little evidence of defensive medicine. I have seen two other studies, both written by the American Medical Association, which I just have to tend to suspect, which argue that there is defensive medicine. But the one empirical study, the study by Harvard, which did not have a bias to go in with, so there wasn't. So I don't think the data is in on that. The data is in on another issue, which I think almost everyone agrees it is forcing or playing a major role in increasing the number of diagnostic tests, radiology studies, extra procedures which are being performed, and that is what has been referred to in a number of articles as physician self-dealing. The New England Journal of Medicine, the Florida Healthcare Cost Containment Task Force, very similar group to this, found that physicians who own their own x-ray machines, laboratories, surgical clinics order up to twice as many x-rays, laboratory tests, and surgical procedures as physicians who don't. And they also charge more for the procedures that are in-house than independent labs do. Now, we haven't looked at that empirically in the state of Alaska, and I don't know whether the same problem exists in Alaska as exists elsewhere. But many states across the country have taken legislative action to deal with this very clear empirical data which shows an abuse of the system which is driving up healthcare costs. Some states have outright prohibited self-dealing. Other states have required physicians to give notice to their patients that there are independent labs across the street which might charge less than the in-house lab. I don't know what the answer is, but I would suggest that this task force look at that issue, which is a documented driver of healthcare costs, and give some consideration to it. Speaking of defensive medicine, I want to respond to something Dr. Thorne raised when I spoke with her yesterday. Some folks have suggested that practice guidelines for physicians might be a good answer to, or might be fit in as a component to helping solve this issue. Practice guidelines are simply trying to get down in a fairly concrete form the kind of care that's required in a certain circumstance, so that physicians can feel comfortable that if they don't have to order the extra test, if their written guideline tells them that they don't, and also that if you end up in court, that the guideline is the best evidence as to whether the physician was negligent or not. If the physician met the guideline, there was no problem. If the physician didn't meet the guideline, there is a problem. The AMA has been trying to get the specialties to do that for years. Many of them, obstetricians and gynecologists, have done that. Hospitals themselves do that. There are lots of published nursing guidelines, and I think that that's something else that the task force can look at. I know that in the packet that the task force members got yesterday or the day before, there are a couple of articles about practice guidelines. I do want to say that that cuts both ways. I was in a trial last year in which the written nursing guidelines for a hospital were violated, and the nurses admitted they violated it, and we thought we had a fairly compelling case, but the expert witnesses came in and said, but guidelines are ideals, and we can never be expected to meet those guidelines. So when you look at guidelines, there's two sides to it, but I think it's something that can be explored. Let me turn to the what I understand are the demands of the CHIPROC proponents, which is contained in the March 14, 1992 facts that I have had a chance to look at just since yesterday. And let's just go down through them and talk about them. Apparently, one of the proposals is that Alaska's existing cap on non-economic damages be reduced from $500,000 to $250,000. Good. I've been talking about the empirical data, so I have to say that of all the empirical data that is out there on whether changes in tort laws affect liability insurance rates, of all the empirical data that is out there, I have to admit that caps on damages seems to have some impact on liability insurance rates as compared to a number of the other proposed reforms that the empirical data just doesn't support. But Alaska in 1986, after a very careful compromise, adopted a cap, a $500,000 cap. And those of us who were involved in that compromise remember clearly what was balanced in that compromise. On the one hand, there was clear evidence that perhaps a cap on non-economic damages would reduce liability insurance rates somewhat, an important thing to do. On the other hand, we had to stop and recognize which victims of malpractice would be most affected, most adversely affected, would have their damages reduced by caps on non-economic damages. And it's clear that the people who are most adversely affected by a cap on non-economic damages are those folks who are not in the wage economy, the people whose damage awards are primarily for non-economic damages. And those people are rural Alaskans, children, and women who are not in the labor economy, not in the wage economy. Recognizing those things, what the legislature did in 86 was balance. There was a proposal for a $250,000 cap. There was a proposals for $750,000 cap. And what the legislature did was balance the various very strong and legitimate competing interests on the cap issue and came up with a $500,000 cap. I think some of you who are sitting around the table were promised that that was the floor. That was the lowest that the medical community would ask for. And, of course, the next year we came back asking, we hear for requests for a lowered cap. But there's a legitimate room for caps in legislation dealing with malpractice litigation. The Alaska legislature recognized that, adopted a cap which considered the competing interests of all people affected by the cap, and I urge you to, as you look at the cap issue, to think about all the competing interests and see which victims you're going to impact the most if you reduce the cap even more. Number two in the CHIPROC proposal is the reduction in plaintiff's contingent fees. I've been waiting for a year.
Mr. Hensley, excuse me. Since the presentations are going to be rather lengthy to go point by point, I'm going to interrupt you and allow Senator Collins to pose a question.
Okay. I will tell you that I don't have a great deal more either, so I'll be happy to answer anybody's question.
Did you have plans to go through all the trip?
No, I have I intend to touch about four of them, but okay. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Senator, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the issue of a cap, I was here in 1986 and sat on Labor and Commerce and was part of the discussion on the compromises that occurred. I recall, and I'll get it for the committee members if I can dig it out of my huge file on tort reform, but do you recall a paper written by Henry Camero, Sandberg, and Hunter that was written, I think, the summer after we passed the 1986 cap? And the premise of that article that he wrote was that, in fact, we didn't have a cap. And I think the title of the article was "The Cap That Wasn't" or something to that effect. Do you recall that?
I haven't seen it.
I'll try to dig up a copy for you because he has a very good explanation of how, even though we thought we had imposed a $500,000 cap, in fact, we hadn't. And he lays that out real well. And I was wondering if you had seen that.
I hadn't, but I could probably get a copy from him directly. And I'd be happy to do that.
I should have it in my box of stuff, but I think that I'd like to discuss that too. Thank you.
Okay, I'll allow more questions and comments if we can keep it to what Mr. Hensley has covered thus far rather than ranging into other things. So if it's on a point already made, Dr. Wilson.
Rob Wilson, I think the point is that yes, a $500,000 cap was adopted, but it does not apply if the person is disfigured or has severe physical impairment. So that vitiates the whole thing, because anybody talking six-figure numbers must have some kind of physical disability, so it really is no cap at all.
Let me respond to that. That was part of the compromise. I think one of the concerns about non-economic damages and one of the allegations, whether it's backed up or not, about pain and suffering damages is that juries award pain and suffering damages that are all out of proportion to the actual damage suffered. And that they're awarding pain and suffering damage, huge amounts of pain and suffering damages to people who haven't suffered. And one of the things that language in the cap that you just read, Doctor, does is ensures that someone who is not seriously injured can't come in and try to convince a jury to award an excessive non-economic damage award. So I see that language as part of the overall compromise and addressing one of the concerns that was raised by the proponents of the cap in the first place.
Senator Kugula.
I was chairman of the both periods discussed in the creation of MICA. I was chairman of the three conference committees that wrote that legislation. It took us over a year. And back in the 70s, and again in 86, I believe, I was chairman of Judiciary, in which we did a lot of the legal work. In other words, what I want to say is if it becomes controversy, I have very detailed files of what was intended to be in both cases. That's about a 20-year file now.
Thank you, Karen. Purdue.
Dan, I'm not really that familiar with the difference between economic and non-economic damages in the sense of how it relates to children, and I'd like you to go over that for a minute, and then the second question is, on the issue of the $250,000 cap, how many, just roughly in your memory, how many states have caps? We have the information on how many states have caps, but we don't know how many have big caps and little caps.
All right. The first one I can address right away. The second one I can probably address, because I think I have it in my brief or something. Juries award in the category of economic damages, lost wages, lost future wages for somebody who's injured and can't work or his or her working capacity or earning capacity is reduced. And they award medical expenses, past medical expenses, and whatever expenses are necessary to provide future care. Those are called economic damages. Juries then also award in the category of non-economic damages, pain and suffering, loss of enjoyment of life, what's known as loss of consortium or damage to either a marital relationship or a family relationship or something in that category, basically, and then damages for disfigurement and emotional distress and those kind of things. And all of those general things lump in to non-economic damages. In the case of a rural subsistence person who's injured and is not in the cash economy, the smaller component of that person's damages is likely to be lost wages. In the case of a person like a woman, even an urban woman, who has chosen not to be in the cash economy, a larger component of her damages, or a smaller component of her damages, is likely to be in terms of lost wages, and a larger component is likely to be the non-economic side of the damage picture. In the case of children, the child is likely to be awarded some wage. If the child is injured so badly that the child is never going to get into the wage, be a wage earner in any event, the child will be awarded wage loss. But the other very often, sometimes significant component of a child's award, if the child is injured and is expected to live for a very, very long time, is simply the recognition that there is going to be pain and suffering and loss of enjoyment of life for a period of 60 or 70 years, especially for a child injured at birth. And that can often be a significant component of that child's damages. And let's face it, although where that money goes is to take care of the child.
Dr. Wilson, did you have another? I'm sorry.
I need to follow up on parent-produced question as to the. I can't summarize it for you, Karen. We have provided the task force members a state-by-state summary of legal reforms adopted in every state in the country, including CAPS, joint and several liability, et cetera. And the summary tells you not only whether the state has adopted a cap, but the size of the cap. And it might save time, than rather going through state by state, I can show you that when we're finished here. That's how we can answer your question. It tells us the size of the cap and whether the state's adopted it at all.
Dr. Wilson and then Larry Bartlett.
I think I can summarize
that. Dr. Wilson, you need to use your mic.
I think I can summarize that for you, Karen, and the others from the document that Mr. Hensley is talking about. These are the states that have caps according to that document. Michigan has a cap on non-economic damages of $225,000 with seven exceptions, which are kind of extenuating circumstances, which undercuts the cap quite a bit. The following five states have a cap of $250,000. California, Colorado, with some minor modifications. Florida has a cap of $250,000. If both sides agree to arbitration, if they don't, it's different and higher. Kansas has a $250,000, and Utah. Maryland has a $350,000 cap on non-economic damages. Hawaii has a $375,000. Idaho has $400,000. Alaska and Oregon have a $500,000, but as we said, Alaska, $500,000 doesn't apply. There's some disfigurement of severe damage. And West Virginia has $1 million. That's non-economic damages on all the roads.
And then the rest of the states don't have caps at all.
Okay.
Then the rest of the states don't have caps at all.
Correct. There are, this is Rod Wilson again, the following states have overall caps, economic and non-economic. Indiana has $650,000, although it's only $100,000 per provider. Louisiana has $500,000, but only $100,000 per provider. Massachusetts has $500,000 overall cap with some modifiers.
How much was that one?
Massachusetts?
Yeah.
New Mexico has $500,000 cap, but that does not include the medical costs or punitive damages. Alabama has $1 million, South Dakota has $1 million, and Virginia has $1 million, and all of the rest of the states don't have an overall cap on all damages.
Let me add one thing to that, Dr. Wilson. I don't know when this summary was prepared, and I can't give you exact details, but in terms of the states that have overall caps on damages, I know at least one or two of those have been declared unconstitutional, and I don't know how many, and if our summary is current on that. And I think there would be a serious constitutional question in Alaska if that were, if an overall cap were placed as well.
I have, Rod Host again, I have some information on the constitutionality from that same document,
okay.
And there may be some updates that are needed. Caps have been declared unconstitutional in six states, Ohio, North Dakota, New Hampshire, Texas, Vermont, and Washington. Caps have been declared constitutional in two states, California and Virginia.
Okay, any further comments or questions before Mr. Hensley proceeds? Please go ahead, Dan.
Thank you. I think we've covered caps pretty thoroughly. Let me move to the number two plank on this March 14th CHIPRA proposal, and that is the suggestion of limitation on contingent fees. As I started to say a moment ago, I've been waiting for almost 2 years to bring this document to this task force attention or anybody who might read it. And I provided to all the members of the task force a brief, a written Supreme Court brief filed by the Citizens Coalition for Tort Reform in the Alaska Supreme Court in June of 1990, where the lawyers for the Citizens Coalition for Tort Reform told the Alaska Supreme Court that the connection between reduced liability insurance rates and lowered plaintiffs' contingent fees was speculative and lacked any factual basis. Those were the people that were proposing the reduction, but they felt compelled to tell the Alaska Supreme Court that that linkage was speculative and lacked any factual basis. That's true. The Zuckerman paper that was attached to the handout that you all got on the task force essentially reaches the same conclusion. Most of the RAND Corporation studies essentially reach the same conclusion. One of the RAND Corporation studies that I cited in the more detailed materials I provided to the task force tells us something else about lawyer fees and complex litigation, which I think it's very, very important for the task force to understand. In complex litigation, although we might all say that the overall fees of the legal system and the cost of processing complicated litigation are high, in that complicated litigation, which includes medical malpractice litigation, the lawyers representing the doctors make, on average, more than the lawyers representing the plaintiffs. So what you would end up getting if you reduced the fees for the lawyers who represent the victims is simply an increased shift in the economic power between the injured victim on this end and the person the injured victim is trying to seek compensation from on this end. That's not fair. That's not fair at all.
On that point, Senator Petrullo?
I'd just like to have that material. I don't have it.
All right. We'll have
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me go down to an issue we can agree on the March 14 CHIPRA proposal, and that is prejudgment interest. The only way the proposal recommends that the law dealing with prejudgment interest be changed so that it only runs from the date of filing the lawsuit rather than the date of the event. I think that's great. That happens to have been part of our law already since 1986. This legislature made that change at the insistence of the Citizens Coalition for Tort Reform 4 years ago. And it seems that perhaps we keep coming back and asking for more and more and more, and we forget what we've already got. But that's already part of the law and has been for half a dozen years now. So plank number four shouldn't be subject to discussion.
Excuse me, Dan, on that point.
Could you give me the citation for that later? I couldn't find it.
Sure. Let me go to what I think is probably the most important issue to many members of the task force, and that's the question of tail insurance for OBGYN practitioners and how that relates to access to the medical care system, particularly access to OBGYN care. Several of you were on the liability insurance task force, which held hearings like this a couple of years ago and gathered a phenomenal amount of data on liability insurance and how rates are made, and whether tort reforms have had any impact on liability insurance rates and whether they're not, and those kind of things. What we learned in that was that this tail problem happened because the insurance companies unilaterally decided to quit writing what they call occurrence policies and changed over to claims made policies. That created a tremendous change in insurance coverage for folks who treated small children, who did births and treated small children, and it created the tail problem, and it's a very legitimate problem. I remember distinctly at the Liability Task Force meeting somebody from MICA indicating that they would very much like to write occurrence policies again for their folks, for their OBGYNs, so that they didn't have the tail problem, but they couldn't get Lloyd's of London and the other big reinsurers to reinsure them, and therefore it wasn't a profitable line of insurance. Several of us on that task force, including the non-lawyer consumer representatives, asked whether we could investigate the possibility of either providing incentives or legislative mandates to write or to find some way of reinsuring occurrence-based liability insurance so we could get rid of the tail problem. And unfortunately, that task force was disbanded and we never really got to that point. I talked to Dave Walsh about it the other day. He's not extremely hopeful, he told me, and I'm sure he can answer that question. But I really think that's something that ought to be explored along with all the other avenues, because that's how the problem began. And it ought to be something that a task force who's really serious about looking at that tail problem ought to focus on. The other question, of course, in dealing with tails is, instead of dealing with the insurance companies who created the tail problem, deal with the legal system, which has a statute of limitations. I promised you, Representative Ellis, that I would canvass the lawyers that I knew and see if people knew injured persons, knew injured victims of malpractice, whose cases would be impacted if there was a reduction in the statute of limitations. And in that canvas, I found about a 50-50 reaction. I don't have any cases in my office, and I'm not aware of any that we've handled that would have been significantly impacted by the change. I found some other people who had people they've spoken to, injured parties they've spoken to, who they would have had to turn away and wouldn't be able to help if there was a change in the law as proposed. So I can't give you a consensus. What I can say is, and just as a representative of a group, that if I went back to my group and I had hard data, empirical data, that said that a reduction in the statute of limitations would cause a significant reduction in liability insurance premiums, and I had hard data that reduction would get some doctors back into the baby delivering business, which is really what I understand is the real concern. But I would be real hard pressed to argue to my group that we shouldn't support that. But I haven't seen that hard data. I'm looking for the hard data. If it's there, that's a very legitimate area of tort law that could be looked at. If the cause and effect is not there, then it's not a legitimate area of the tort law to look at. I will, if you like, I can continue to talk with members of my group about the issue and explore it more, or do more canvassing, a more thorough canvassing, and try to give you data or actual numbers, and do anything else you'd like for me to do on that issue. Those are the comments I have on the overall proposal. What I'd hope to do in my presentation is give you some historical perception on not only what has been happening in tort reform in the state for the last 20 years, but also refocus your attention on the empirical data, which has shown that for the most part, changes in the tort system have had virtually no, or at least only modest, impacts on liability insurance rates. I'd be happy to answer any questions. As I've told some of you, I'm also available to do canvassing of my own members to gather data from folks who practice in the area of personal injury law, and do anything else I can to provide useful information for this task force to make decisions based on facts rather than assumptions or anecdotal information.
Mr. Hensley, we appreciate your presentation. Senator Collins?
Thank you. thank you. Just to summarize, I guess what I think I've heard from you, is that you know, based on the information or the empirical data that you have, that it does not appear that either the cost incurred as a result of medical malpractice, the cost incurred as a result of defensive medicine, that those are insignificant cost drivers to the medical system. Is that correct?
The cost of medical malpractice liability premiums are less than 1% of the overall health care costs. The cost of defensive medicine is the subject of a unresolved factual controversy. And it depends on who defines the issue. It depends on the data that is used to look at the issue. The New York study, which many think is an unbiased and fairly accurate and empirical study, seems to suggest that defensive medicine, that there may be many other answers for what is being defined as defensive medicine, such as availability of new technology and those kind of things, as opposed to merely ordering a test to keep from being sued. I think the jury is not in on defensive medicine, but I think it's unwise to assume that what is defined as defensive medicine is resulting solely as a result of fear of lawsuits, when there are at least a number of other factors out there which suggest that that's not the case. And I think it's something that could be looked at more. I think that unlike some of the other tort reforms which have had about a 10-year study period, and we have some pretty good data on it, the data on what has been defined as defensive medicine isn't very good yet, and I think it'd be pretty unwise to make radical changes to the tort system based on information that may well be suspect.
I guess I'm still not sure that, I guess what I'm trying to determine from you is the degree of the problem. I mean, my feeling is that if in looking at the issue of cost containment, if the whole issue of medical malpractice, if it plays a significant role in the cost of medicine, then it needs to be addressed. If it doesn't play a significant role, then perhaps it doesn't need addressed. And I guess what I'm trying to do is get from you an opinion whether you think it's something that, my position is really kind of clear. I feel that if we have to do some cost containment, that we need to look at all of the factors and modify all of the factors that contribute to the high cost of health care. And I guess I've always felt that one of them was, all the legal expense and all that goes with it. And I guess the degree that we make adjustments depends to what degree is the problem. If it's a 5% problem or a 50% problem, you deal with it differently. And I'm just trying to understand from you, you know, is it a 5% problem or a 50% problem? And to me, that has an impact on any adjustments that we do or do not make. And
I think that the data says it's a less than 1% problem. Obviously, given the amount of time that we're spending here, the emotional aspect of it is a significantly higher problem than what the empirical data shows.
So then your recommendation would be that we, in order to deal with cost containment, we don't need to address the medical malpractice liability issue?
Yes.
Okay, Senator Kurtula, then Larry Bartlett, then Dr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've found my experience that there's been a real problem with OBGYN in insurance for those particular segment of the medical community. Now, occurrence, as you say, is not become available in many areas of the country. Do you know specific areas of the nation that you can still, specific companies dealing with specific areas of this country, U.S., that you can still get occurrence coverage?
I don't know. Dave knows.
That's fine.
Which one?
The inwards.
And Dave, my further question then would be, if it's available, under what terms is that available that couldn't be made available in this country if we adopt it? Now, I recognize, as a caveat, that we have a very small group of providers here and a very small group that can, we probably couldn't leverage any insurance coverage or any Alaska. We ran that for years. But still, I want to know if there's areas that have occurrence and again, what they do in those states or those areas to get it.
This is Dave Walsh from the Division of Insurance. Senator Kurtula, occurrence policies, not just in medical malpractice, but in all areas of insurance, are becoming very scarce, not only in the United States, but all over the world. The long tail policies for any type of coverage is a product that, all the companies, virtually all the companies, no longer wish to provide because of the basically unlimited exposure. Where you can get a tail coverage in a professional situation is, for example, where someone ceases practice. When I closed my law practice to take this job, I bought a closeout policy with a long tail. But that's a one-time, phenomenally expensive premium. There is no, to my knowledge, occurrence-based coverage available in any of the professions, and probably not in any commercial risks in this country. If it is, it would be phenomenally expensive, and to be honest, I don't know of any anywhere that would take care of this kind of problem.
Well, Mr. Chairman, of course, I was very distressed with what they've done to MICA, and I think there's some self-service in collapsing that whole program. But again, the facts are that this may be one of the social problems that we would have to test to as a state and a nation in legislation and providing a taxpayer base, because that is a problem for doctors that must practice. We must have their services. We see more and more people with less and less qualifications, good as midwives and so on may be, in this practice, because there's a need out there for this service. And, that's a very, very big problem. We either have to get occurrence or we have to do something. Thank you.
Ms. Chairman and Senator Cotulli, if I might just kind of finish up, I meant to mention before that in preparation for this meeting, we called a couple of the larger companies, not a couple that provide medical malpractice, but also that just provide general commercial or professional insurance, and ask them what, if any, incentives would be possible for them to get back into that business. And, you know, and we mentioned some tort reform, limitation of liability, limitation of damages, et cetera. And they all said that they didn't know of any. That is just, it's a product with a long exposure. They don't wish their capital and surplus to be tied up, and it's just something that is going to be removed from the marketplace. They had no suggestions as to things we might consider to as incentives to bring that product back on the market.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. This will tie very well into Professor Weiss's coming discussion with us. Thank you.
Okay, Larry, and then Dr. Wilson.
Dan, this is Larry Bartlett. Dan, I get the sense that there are two comments or two issues raised with that, sort of the focus on OBs being an important one. You had also talked about the willingness to, or the recognition that if there were empirical data that said that there were some positive relationships, that might be a good reason for focusing attention. I apologize if you talked about pre-screening panels. I might have missed it while I was flipping through a lot of my materials. But one of the documents that I shared with Nancy, and that's in everyone's packet, is a 1990 article, Zuckerman, Bobberg, and Sloan. Now, it's a big sort of regression analysis and all, and looks at issues. But on page 176 of that article, if I can just read a sentence or two, and then maybe turn it back to you. It says, establishing pretrial screening panels reduces obstetrics gynecology premiums by about 7% a year after they're introduced. In the long run, this effect is 20%. For other specialties, panels lower premiums, but the coefficients are not significant. The results suggest that panels may be more effective in screening non-meritorious cases or encouraging out-of-court settlements and claims involving OBGYNs, since OBGYNs are among those incurring the highest insurance expenses and are often the driving force behind reform initiatives, legislators may view this somewhat limited finding of effectiveness as adequate reason for establishing panels. Would you like to comment on the whole pre-trial screening panels, please?
Sure. I read that this morning about 7 o'clock,
yeah.
And it was too early because I forgot about it. Alaska has a pretrial screening panel structure already set up, and it's been in existence since 1976. It was one of the earliest demands that tort reform demands that was made and adopted by the legislature. I suspect that that this article is right, and one of the reasons I think it's right is because in the area of obstetrics is because obstetrics has adopted some nationwide written standards. So it's easier to screen cases when you have some written standards to judge your facts by. Overall, we have, and I have to be anecdotal rather than empirical here, but overall, not very many people have been satisfied with the screening program that has been going on in the Alaska court system. And I'm speaking both about insurers, and I'm speaking of lawyers who represent doctors, and I'm speaking of plaintiff's lawyers, and primarily because there are lots and lots of those cases where the panels just don't devote the time to them to do justice to the case. So we don't really get any help from the panel, but it delays the case and costs more. But my answer to you is yes, we have a panel system already, and to the extent that it works well, then it may be doing some of what you're talking about already.
Dan, just to, this is Larry Bartlett again, just a follow-up comment. I'm not sure if you want to add on to that. I've already apologized to this group that our timing is off. We are in the process of, in other words, that we're doing, looking at malpractice and looking in much closer detail at some of these pretrial screening panels and some of our early meetings with state folks who had these panels. We've seen an incredible variation from there being voluntary to there being mandatory, and no one seems tremendously happy with the process. Everyone says, you know, here the, if I were king, here are the three or four things I'd do to improve that process. This suggests to me that maybe the concept of the process has some merit. Maybe in certain states, maybe Alaska being one of them, the way in which that concept is carried out may not be working all that well. Are there some things that you do to improve what's being done now?
Well, I don't know whether I can prove it. Let me tell you. The fundamental problem with Alaska's screening panel is that we have a small physician pool, and you're asking Alaskan physicians to review the care of other physicians that they scrub with, that they socialize with, that refer them cases, and that is a very, very difficult thing to do. And many of us have got together and talked about trying to get screening panels involving non-Alaskan physicians. Some of the judges have said the statute doesn't require non-Alaskan physicians. Nobody said you had to get three physicians from Alaska who happen to all own the same clinic or have partnership in the same clinic as the defendant. The problem is that the screening panel is voluntary. The physicians get paid peanuts for their work on it, and finding outside physicians who don't have those social problems is going to be costly. It's going to add cost to the system. I think that's the major problem.
I'd like to note that Roxana Horschel has joined us. I guess the fog bank parted out at the airport, and you're here. We're glad to have you. And I'd also like to, before we proceed, acknowledge the presence and participation of Senator Sturdzielewski. I've been extremely impressed with your commitment to the task force process, Senator, and we know it's going to pay off as our recommendations make their way through the program. Carlos, thank you for being here. Okay, Dr. Wilson is next in the lineup.
Only if there's wisdom.
I could talk all day about the panel system, if you all were interested, but I'm not. I was in on the original design of them in the eight statutory questions that are asked of the panel about the nature of the case and whether an injury arose out of medical care. Ann Carpinetti and I wrote right down in that room in the corner in 1976. The panel is unique in the nation, I think, in that there are three physicians only on it. Others have a lawyer and a doctor and somebody else, or a lawyer moderating a doctor panel and so forth. There are a lot of false too with it, among which are the one you mentioned, that we tend to know each other. It is not true that three panel members from the same clinic as the defendant doctor would ever be on the panel. That certainly doesn't happen, nor does it happen that the doctors, I don't think it's happened very much that doctors, even in business with another doctor, say owning a piece of property with them, on the same panel. We've tried to avoid that. It is a great problem with recruitment to try to find three doctors for an aggregate case. We often try to find a Fairbanks panel and vice versa. But it is a difficult problem for to panel the members. Once we did have an anatomist from the University of Washington, but there's no way to pay them. The doctors in this system get either paid peanuts and generally don't even bother to build a court, which has no budget for this anyway. The panel system in some ways has worked pretty well in that cases that involve a real misunderstanding of the biology of what was going on, just kind of confusion. I'm not saying they're frivolous cases, but it's just misunderstanding what the case or the disease is all about. They are fairly well and quickly disposed of and dismissed. So that overall, as I've said before, the panel system has found fault with the plaintiff. You don't quite answer the question whether it's malpractice or not, but that a medical injury arose out of unskillful care, which is very close to that, and about 22-24%, which is about the same percentage overall as go to trial. So, but we think it's a different set of fault than perhaps comes out of the jury system where other factors come in. It's very easy, believe me, for the three panelists, doctors panelists, to know when there's been bad medicine. That's easy. Doctors rarely argue much about that. Now, the fine points of the law, the standards and all this and that is another question, but docs know when something has been poorly done. So much for the panel. Going back to the cost issue, don't dismiss lightly 0.8% of what's now over $700 billion. That approaches $6 billion. You know, we're just talking about the premiums and the cost of litigation and not the defensive medicine, which may be upwards another $15 billion, depending on how you define it. Sam Rayburn said once, a million here and a million there. I don't know whether he said a billion or a million, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. If we could find an area of medicine, say unnecessary surgery on the back or something that was costing $6 billion, we'd just love to stop that, wouldn't we? So don't dismiss lightly that 0.8% of a big number is unimportant, and indeed that's what this task force is half about. It's about cost. The other half is access. And we're looking for both little ways and big ways to do it. And since this whole system of adjudicating medical malpractice costs is, or practice cases is so inefficient and slow, and only 40% or less trickling down to the patient, we shouldn't forget about it as a cost-saving device.
Okay, Dave Walsh, and any other comments for Mr. Hensley, because we need to move along.
I defer to Mr. Hensley. I have a question on what Mr. Hensley said that I'd like to ask of Rob, but I'll defer to Dan to finish up.
I don't dismiss lightly $6 billion, nor does anybody around the table. What I hope that this task force won't dismiss lightly is the question of whether the victims of medical malpractice are going to be asked to carry on their backs the other 99.2% of the problem, and that seems to be where at least the bulk of the discussion seems to be carrying us. And I just hoped to put in perspective the relationship between the legal system and the overall healthcare delivery system by use of those numbers. And I don't have any other comments. I'm open for questions.
Mr. Hensley, thank you. Why don't you stay at the table there, and we'll turn now to Rod Wilson for his presentation of the expanded SHPRA proposal, and then we'll hear from Dave Walsh and then from Dr. Wise. So with that, Rod?
Does Dave have a question right now?
I'll wait.
Okay. And Rod, let me consult you here. We probably at 10:45, we want to take a 5 or 10 minute break.
Yeah.
Or do we want to take the break now? We should take the break now before I go. Okay, let's declare a 10-minute break. Okay, the copycat clatch here behind me is just about to wind up.
Okay, let's go ahead and reconvene the task force meeting with presentation on medical malpractice from Dr. Wilson. And we will proceed in the same manner that we did with Mr. Hensley. Try and let Rod get through an entire point before the hands shoot up. But we will take it point by point for comment and question. Dr. Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have before you a 1.5-pager. I can't restrain myself from making an initial remark in response to Mr. Hensley's learned presentation, and to say that really providers are not seeking for complete immunity from lawsuit over their negligent acts. If that were the case, we wouldn't be ultimately recommending that there needs to be an alternative method of doing this. I don't think the present method is very good. Also, in spite of the fact that there's not a lot of good empirical data about the effects of this or that tort law change, et cetera, on medical malpractice insurance and litigation costs, there does seem to be experience, particularly in California, that suggests that you can reduce costs if you do some of the tort law changes. We had hoped to have had, although we hadn't cleared it with the chairs, a speaker from California here, namely Brad Cohn, C-O-H-N, M.D., a pediatrician in California, who's been very prominent in creating the doctor's insurance company down there. He's an authority in this entire field, and he might have come here but for the fact that the California Medical Association is meeting this week. He said he would come any other time if indeed this task force has later life. As he put it, he'll come on his dime any time, and he really knows a lot about this subject. When at the end of the last meeting, I think we had on Larry's flip chart 7 or 8 items, and after discussing with the CHIPRA folks and with Brad Cohen by telephone, et cetera, with your indulgence, I've expanded it to 10 items. Sorry about that. I could have lumped a couple and still come out with them. And I'd like to go through these now. Most of them have to do with trying to reduce costs of the entire system. Others, as you get down the list, are more in a way quality of life, or at least quality of medical life, comfort and enjoyment of the practice, rather than strictly dollar matters. And that's not to say that we don't think that there are secondary benefits to the public in all of this. Now, on this sheet, the first three together, which isn't on here, and I could call 3A periodic payment system, which we already have in Alaska law, and that's why I didn't list it. It caps on awards for non-economic damages, limitation on contingency fees, collateral source rule, and periodic payments. Those four elements are considered by many to be the most powerful and important changes in tort law that affect price. And indeed, those are the four that the 1975 California MICRA Act really focused on and solidified. And as a result, in California, they believe, and this is certainly documented by the price of the malpractice insurance, that having those four elements, caps, limitation on contingency fees, collateral source, and periodic payment law, lowered their malpractice premiums in California by a third to a half. We don't have these, and our costs up here are at least a third to a half higher than California. In addition, it has made a stable, predictable market, and I don't have the number, but far fewer California physicians go bare because they do have affordable insurance. How many physicians are bare in Alaska? I don't know. Maybe someone else knows, but they won't tell you. I don't blame them for not telling you. But it may be as high as 30% of the physicians in Alaska are bare. Second thing that these four elements have done in California is that it's assured that high-risk services, like obstetrical care, full obstetrical care, and like neurosurgical procedures, and I could name others, are really available. In some jurisdictions or states where the malpractice scene is greatly awry, perhaps more so than in Alaska, even Florida, you just can't get things done, and that's bad. For example, in Florida, it's very difficult to get a surgeon to do a bleeding or leaking aneurysm of the aorta, either in the chest or the abdomen. It's too high risk. Have them die anyway, no matter what you do. It's real risky business. The same for the little berry aneurysms in the brain that happen to younger people, as a rule. Leaking berry aneurysm in the brain. High risk. Few people come out of it whole. Most of them die. Many of them end up paralyzed or something. That's very high risk stuff. And unless a neurosurgeon who does that work feels comfortable in terms of his own exposure, they're just not going to do those. They go to another state and usually die before they get there. So California feels that high-risk medicine procedures, etc., are available because the market is now stable and insurance is affordable. And the third is that they do believe that general medical costs have been lowered in California. Now, in 1975, California was just about at the top of the list in terms of overall medical costs. In 1991, using something called Medical Care Service Index, and don't ask me what that is because I don't know, is below the national average. So there we find that the medical costs overall are less than the national average in California, where everything else seems to be as high as almost anywhere. And the average family medical insurance costs in California in 1991 are $4,400 compared to New York State, $5,600. So they do believe that these tort reform changes in MICRA of 1975 have lowered medical costs. Contrary-wise, in Ohio, where their cap was declared unconstitutional, costs went up after the cap was removed. And I can't find that for the moment, but I'll look for it later if you're interested. Going back now to the first thing, the cap, we've talked already about it some. And we don't feel that there really is a cap in Alaska for the reasons I've already talked about. And remember, the cap on non-economic damages, as I'm sure you realize, this has nothing to do with the economic damage. There's no ceiling on that. The limitation on contingency fee, CHIPRA really recommends the California scale, which is reasonably generous. You can see it there. 12 states have regulation of contingency fees. They are California, Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Illinois, Indiana in part. That has to do with a state fund over the $100,000 per provider that have another $500,000 in Indiana for award, but the contingency fee on that portion is only 15%. Going on with other states who have contingency fees regulated are Maine, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Utah, and Wisconsin. I don't know what the typical contingency fee is in Alaska. It's my understanding that it's considered unethical for an attorney to have more than an equal or greater, indeed a greater interest in a case than his or her client does. So 49%, I guess, would be the top, but I don't think Alaska lawyers would ever be so obtuse as to ask for that much in a contingency fee. I wish there were, and Dave Walsh has spoken of this before, a way to limit defense costs, too. Perhaps there could be DRGs or some kind of caps or a limitation of the number of expert witnesses or the number of interrogatories or something. I just don't know. I wish we could figure out some ways to limit the costs on that side, too. Ms. Hensley said that we have one of the strongest collateral source rules in Alaska right now. We don't think it's quite strong enough because we wish, as in California, that the jury knew about the collateral sources and that both the defense say could present those as facts and that the plaintiff could talk about it, argue why they shouldn't be considered because the person has already spent good insurance money or otherwise, or if they're counted, it uses up their lifetime benefit or something. That's all legitimate, but we think that in addition, after that presentation to the jury, that the court could instruct the jury as to how to handle the collateral sources, whether to ignore them or whether to consider them or something in between. We think the law could be strengthened. That would make it better than California's collateral source rule, where the jury is told but not given any instructions as to how to handle it or what that means. Number four, we can skip because Mr. Henry pointed out that already is the law, that it only ticks from the interest ticks from the time that the lawsuit is filed or served. Repeal of number five is repeal of Alaska Rule of Court 82, which says that the party recovering, the prevailing party can recover attorney fees in a case. Now, there's a schedule for that in the Rule 82, and I've actually got it here somewhere. If somebody wants to read it, it's kind of short. But in a $500,000 award, the schedule would add 10.5%, or $52,500, on top of the whole award. And then, as I understand it, and correct me, Dan, if I'm wrong, then the contingency fee, whatever that original arrangement was, is figured on that augmented total package. It's not that the attorney himself would get the $52,500, it's just figured into the whole package. We think this adds to the cost by, let's say, 10% on awards. Now, there's a downside to repealing Rule 82 from our standpoint, and that is that it might encourage frivolous suits, because one of the limiting or governing factors on that is that if a plaintiff filed a outlandish suit on a long shot because of Rule 82, they might have to pay the attorney's fees, because if they lose, then the defendant is the prevailing side. So it might encourage more frivolous suits. And I said before, I don't think we have a whole lot of frivolous suits in Alaska. We have misunderstanding about what was going on, but not real frivolity. Number six has to do with OB, and we've talked a lot about that, and really something we as a task force ought to do, try to do something about obstetrical care. Karen and Jay have distributed before the studies that the department made about the impact of the legal climate on OB family practitioners not daring to do it, even though well-trained in it. Well-trained obstetricians dropping out of OB after 8 or 10 years of really a short practice for something that they spent years and years to train, and then dropping out in part, if not in totally sometime, because they either can't afford the $90,000 annual premium, or because they're tired of the exposure of being bare, and a lot of them are bare, and they just can't live with that stress and discomfort any longer. That redounds badly to the proper care of the public, and we're suggesting that, I might say a little more, that three-quarters of OBGYN doctors in the country have been sued. Have a suit. 75% of them have a suit. The average is 3 suits. Premiums went up nationally 71% between 1984 and 1989 for obstetrical care. And nationally, in 1991, 1 of 8 obstetricians stopped OB. It's a terrible social waste. So we think that a new standard of proof should obtain in medical malpractice on anything having to do with delivery of a baby. Not the whole smear of prenatal or postnatal care, but just events coming out of that critical and wonderful moment of delivery of a baby. And that's where most of the problems arise. And we're suggesting that a clear, convincing standard of proof be applied, and that's substantially higher than the standard of preponderance of the evidence. Another national aspect of this, in community health centers across the country, liability premiums for OB increased between 88 and 91 alone from $30 to $58 million. So those community health care centers really had to cut back services. It was calculated to 500,000 people simply because of the malpractice premiums on OB. And many counties in the country simply have no OB coverage whatsoever. With reference, Dan, to your going on to the set of the statute of limitations, with reference to the canvas, was that extending it for 1 year for infants, or was it the matter of saying that any infant, any claim arising out of care of an infant below the age of 6 would be extended to age 8?
I think it gives it too much credit to call it a canvas. I got on the phone and talked to those people I could reach in a short period of time after I got the invitation to come down here. I know I was talking to Dr. Thorne about it yesterday. I'm not sure now that you asked me whether I spoke about it in terms of specific 1 year, increasing it from 2 to 3 years, or whether we talked about a 5-year or 6-year case. And I'm going to have to, in deference to be accurate, to call back and find out for sure. Okay. I misunderstood when I was talking to Dr. Yeah. Thorne yesterday what this proposal said, and I may have not asked the right questions of my colleagues because of that, so I'm not sure I can give you a clear answer.
Okay. Well, whatever. Tipper is recommending that it be as it's written there. For any event in a child under 6, say meningitis at age 1, that has nothing to do with OB or anything, but a claim of the mishandling of meningitis at age 1, really the statute of limitations there would be 7 years, and there's a good purpose for that. On damaged children, particularly brain damaged, a lot of the subtler defects don't come out until they get into school. So that's why the age 8 is recommended. But on the other hand, it cuts out the business of waiting until the age of majority, which for this purpose is 19 plus 2 years, and that we think should cut down on the tail costs of insurance, although overall I agree with others who have stated that the statute of limitation changes don't have a whole lot to do with the costs. They have a lot to do with comfort and fairness, I think. Number 8 is a matter of hospitals not being vicariously liable, and I'm not quite sure in my mind what vicariously means legally, but it arises out of the Fairbanks-Jackson versus Powers case in an emergency room situation where the hospital was held liable, and we think that that's not fair for hospitals to be held liable for actions of non-employees like anesthesiologists and pathologists and radiologists who happen to be working at the hospital but not paid by the hospital.
Senator Cartula?
He's through with 8. I just have one quick question to that. Let's face it, the leading hospitals, the good hospitals, don't they, though, set standards and set up a system which allows certain people to practice with certain qualifications, and some people are allowed to practice and some not? That's one of our big controls, I always felt, in getting qualified physicians in a given discipline to practice. So a good hospital, quote, a good hospital would have certain standards for performance. In of that, then, wouldn't they have some modest liability for letting in people to practice? I don't know, but I've often wondered. They set a standard, the person meets it.
Yeah, I think certainly all hospitals, except maybe one-man hospitals, if the doc owns himself, have a credentialing process, a very elaborate and carefully process. They don't decide on practice standards for a particular doctor, but just their educational experience and so forth. And yeah, that certainly does involve the hospital, and there is a deep responsibility for that, and I guess that's a part of what the word vicarious means. It's a fine line, but it's a terror. The Jackson versus Paris terrified hospitals in terms of and really, it's a deep pocket issue. That's where the money is. I don't think that answers your question, but I understand this particular issue only imperfectly. Going on to 9, we think that punitive damages should go to the state rather than to the party. And ideally, it ultimately should wind up with the state medical board to help support their budget for disciplinary and public educational activities. We think that would be a more useful use of punitive damages. I think punitive damages in medical malpractice have been rare in Alaska. Maybe they've never been applied. And finally, this Chan was at my personal top of the list, but now, after talking with the among us Chipper people and others, it's at the bottom of the list, at least in terms of immediate importance, because as we talked more about it, the more and more complex it became. Ultimately, however, I'm convinced that we need a new system to adjudicate claims of medical malpractice. Mr. Mentley has cited the Harvard studies. I have a couple of them here. I think there are other papers. And incidentally, I think you said that they were based on 40,000 bad outcomes. Really, it was 30,000. A sample of 30,000 cases.
Charts, 30,000 charts and cases.
30,000 what?
Charts.
chart.
Whatever it says.
Yeah, but that wasn't 30,000 bad outcome. Anyway, in the long run, I think that a different system, one that's quicker, fairer, much more even-handed, less capricious, more efficient in their use of money, less dilatory, less agonizing to all the parties, really needs to be a part of a reconstructed method.